From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Technology brings change, and sometimes how we want to change brings about new technology. The Federal Clean Air Act mandates that in a few short years, all car manufacturers must be able to provide cars which produce zero emissions. Unfortunately, the technology is not quite here yet. Dr. Sheldon Kamenecki is the director of the Environmental Studies Program at the University of Southern California. His areas of research include air quality, water quality, and energy use. I'll speak with him about the state of technology regarding the new electric cars. I'll also talk with Elizabeth McGrath and Nick Bassoni. They are pioneering a business use for the new virtual world entertainment centers, which are opening now across the country. I'll speak to them about how organizations can soon use virtual reality to get their people to work together. Sheldon Kamenecki's research addresses the complex area of the environment. When I think of environmental problems and their policies, I think of very complex technological situations. Curiously, Dr. Sheldon's background is in political science. I asked about that.
When I think of environmental problems, being a political scientist, I think of them in political, economic, and social terms, much more broadly defined than perhaps from a technological perspective. However, the reality is that it's a mosaic of both technological, scientific, political, economic, and social factors, and we need to understand all those ingredients if we're going to understand the problems concerning the environment and what kind of solutions we need.
Well, let's start with state regulations. The state of California has mandated that by 1998, 2% of the state's vehicles must be electric. Now, why is this, and what does it mean?
Well, let me just add that in addition to that, by 2001, it has to go up to 5%, and 2003, 10%. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but it's 300,000 vehicles. The reason for that is that there are certain areas in California, such as Southern California, that have very poor air quality. It's primarily due to the use of automobiles. In fact, in Southern California, 70-75% of the smog is the result of automobile emissions. And the state and the federal government said, finally, we've got to do something drastic, fairly drastic about it. Otherwise, we're going to continue to pollute the air, harm the public health, and certainly hurt the environment.
Now, when we say 2%, 5%, 10%. Are we talking about vehicles in general, or are we talking about fleets that belong to the state of California?
The specifics of the mandate is for each major automobile manufacturer, General Motors, Chrysler, Ford, Toyota, and so on down the list. There's about 12 to 15 major ones who will have to sell 2% of their automobiles will have to be electric or zero emissions, which is probably electric.
Let me get this straight. Every single manufacturer has to come up with an electric car?
Yes. Otherwise, they cannot do business in California. They cannot sell any cars in California. The other 98%.
California. I don't even have to look at the statistics to know you want to be selling cars
you
in California.
You want to be, and it's no accident. It's kind of an interesting situation because, on the one hand, clearly, they are being pressured economically to do this. On the other hand, because of the size of California, this is going to definitely set a trend for the rest of the country, because if you're going to do this in California, you might as well start thinking about the Northeast. In fact, the 12 Northeastern states are now seriously thinking about adopting not only this, but other kinds of regulations and mandates that California has adopted. They're still considering that.
This is 1994, and the 2% mandate is 1998. That means like 3 years from now. It actually might be 2.5, as I recall, if you're going to buy a 1996 car. You can actually buy it in 1995. Very
early. Right.
This
would be 1997. Right.
This would be 1997.
Right.
How close are we to having electric cars?
Well, there are already a number of young independent entrepreneurs are already taking rabbits this morning. In fact, I saw a rabbit at Mike's Auto Care Shop in San Mateo, fully equipped and converted into an electric car. There's someone down in Orange County who's already sold 50 Geo Metro cars that he bought from General Motors, took out all the gasoline parts and the engine and everything and converted it to an electric car. So we're already starting that. General Motors has the Impact, their prototype, and Ford already has the EcoStar, and they've been testing both of them for the last 2-3 years. There are already battery companies that are racing to try to develop the battery, which is one of the main problems for the electric cars. So this is well underway. Clearly, the major automobile companies, though, in all fairness, think it's impossible. They think they cannot do it, and the gasoline companies support that.
Well, I hope the gasoline companies get in the battery business, but other than that, this would be helpful. Now, how exactly does it work?
Basically, you have perhaps 6 or 8 6-volt batteries that cycle very low that can store a considerable amount of electricity, and you basically plug in like you would a battery to recharge in your laptop computer or your radio if you have a portable radio with batteries. You charge it up overnight, takes about 8 hours, and then the next day you can go about 75 to 100 miles between point A and point B before you have to recharge it again.
You're here at your home, so you charge your car at home, and then you drive 60 miles down the road. Often in California this happens, and you go to work. Do you think there'll be a place to recharge your battery at
Yeah,
work?
we hope that this will be institutionalized. Already in many parts of the country, although the colder parts, there are already plug-ins for blankets and heating sticks to keep the engine warm. We're hoping that things will change and that there'll be outlets made available at places of work and other places where, for example, parking garages where people are you know, tend to leave their car for a extended period of time. This all sounds very radical, like a radical change, but don't forget it wasn't that long ago when we were all using leaded gasoline. The oil and gasoline companies complained there's no way we're going to be able to use no leaded gasoline. It's going to cost too much. We're not going to be able to supply everybody and so on. And slowly but surely, as we speak today, you cannot find leaded gasoline. So we did make that change from leaded to no leaded. We can make this change as well.
Would you be able to run off general, simple household electricity?
Yeah, it's 110-volt socket, and you just plug it in. It's no problem.
Well, what occurs to me pretty simply is everywhere you go, just about, there's electricity.
Yeah.
And there's 110 volts.
Not too difficult. No, it's not too difficult.
This all came off of, as I understand it, trying to comply with the Clean Air Act. What
right.
exactly is that?
Well, we actually had our first Clean Air Act in 1970. It was revised in 77 and just revised in 1990. And it gives areas of the country that are polluted 3 to 20 years to meet the federal standards beginning in 1990. The worst air quality in the country is Southern California. That was the only area given 20 years. It forces the states and the localities to come up with a plan that will meet those goals. And it sets about standards which we have to meet. It does some other things too, controls acid rain and does other things that were not in the other previous Clean Air Act amendments.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. Sheldon Kamenecki. He's the director of the Environmental Studies Program at the University of Southern California, and he is also a professor in the Political Science Department. You're from Los Angeles, and there are more L.A. freeway jokes and L.A. smog jokes than anybody has time for. What about the rest of the country? We know that electric cars can improve the Los Angeles situation, but is there really a need for them in Montana or Nevada?
Or New York or Boston or Philadelphia or Cleveland or Akron or Gary? Yes, clearly, although Southern California has the worst air quality, these other places are not far behind. And that's only in the U.S. We haven't talked about Mexico City today yet. We haven't talked about Eastern Europe, which is choking to death. This also brings up the question of where are we going to get all this electricity? Clearly, this means if everyone's plugging in, although they will be plugging in presumably at night when the capacity is the lowest in terms of the use of the utilities, sooner or later we're going to need to build perhaps more electrical generating plants. Where is this going to come from? Are we going to go to solar power, wind power, both of which are long way being developed on a mass scale? Nuclear power, do we need to revive that? Some argue we do. It's zero emissions as opposed to coal or oil-burning power plants, which may be negating, partially, any gains that would be made going to electric power. So those questions need to be addressed as well.
Obviously, there's been analyses done on what the additional burden would be in electrical power. Now, I'm always interested in how this affects my household budget, or I don't have a household budget, my household expenditures. Now, I know pretty much how much my electricity bill is, and I know when I switch refrigerators or any of these things, what happens. What is it comparable to? I take my electric car home. Let's say I drive it 50 miles a day, so I recharge it once a day. What would be the add-on?
Let's say 8 hours it takes to recharge, the cost of basically running your refrigerator for 8 hours, probably be about $1.50.
Well, that's a lot cheaper than gas, isn't it?
Yes. The only problem is that right now the battery technology that we have only goes for, we have to recharge it between 75 and 100 miles. There is a firm in Michigan, Ovonic Battery Systems, and they're looking at a nickel metal hydride type battery. And there's also a firm up in Bellevue, Washington that's developing a flywheel battery. And both of those have, a lot of potential for increasing in between charges so that it could conceivably very strongly rival gasoline.
This is so much like so many other areas that once you say we're going to go down this path, a whole lot of people jump in with a whole lot of different technology. And they aren't all successful, but they really start to change the parameters.
Sounding like a political scientist for a moment, in our capitalist system, there are good things about it and there are bad things. One of the bad things is that those in power, financially and economically, basically control what kind of products we have and the choices we make as consumers as well as society. Unless they're regulated and told directly what to do for the betterment and the good of the public as opposed to their pockets, they won't do it. And this is one of those situations where we've been using the same kind of engine since 1910, day one. Nothing's really has changed despite their advertising about the internal combustion engine. It still pollutes. We need to go down another path to clean up the environment, to protect our children and the elderly in terms of their lung damage that they receive as a result of smog and living in smoggy areas. And the government has wisely said in a phased-in process, giving them, the automobile companies a lot of time to direct them through regulation to do this. Otherwise, they won't do it.
Now, this leads me to something else. You were alluding to it earlier, international environmental policy. How could we possibly have an international environmental policy? What could affect or implement such a policy?
Well, to start, the most obvious place is the UN, the United Nations Environmental Program, which is an agency actually headed by Mustafa Tomba from an African country who oversees international environmental efforts, endangered species, protection of rainforests, ozone layer. They sponsored the Earth Summit in 1992 in Rio, and that's a good place to start. In addition to which, the U.S. is a model. It sets an example. If we're all wearing Levi's and drinking Coca-Cola, the rest of the world will, sad as it sounds, will do the same. If we start going to electric cars and that becomes the chic thing to do, the modern thing to do, the Western thing to do, The rest of the world will do it too. It's been pretty much the case so far. Even when you include Japan and Germany, those two really respect the U.S. and feel that the U.S. is a model. And I think that this could set new standards that can influence, at least indirectly, the rest of the world.
Well, I do know that many places in the rest of the world, that they are, in fact, having that realization as well. It's not just here in the United States. An example would be, I remember I was traveling in Capri, up on top of this beautiful island, sensational island. There are only little electric carts, and it's wonderful and it's clean. And then quite often, if you go to Capri, you'll end up going to Florence at some point. And there has been more damage, they say, in Florence done from the cars post-World War II than in all the centuries.
Yeah. Oh, and in Rome, too, all the outside the statues, that the whole city is a museum, if anyone's been there, and the damage from the pollution. There's no catalytic converters or anything, and it's there's very little refinement of the gasoline, and it's really done a major, major damage on the buildings and the statues that are thousands, hundreds of years old.
And it's
same thing in London, too, by the way.
It's relatively recent damage, which is interesting.
Yes, and primarily because the increase in vehicle traffic, trucks, and so on. In Eastern Europe, it's the worst, no doubt. Those governments made a conscious decision to put production ahead of, let alone environment, public health. And they don't have a choice, though, if they're going to, let's say, use electric cars or try to clean up their environment. They don't have coal or certainly oil. They're probably going to go with nuclear power because of the kind of technology that's available now to them in terms of the foreign aid that they're getting and the resources they have, and their pollution problems are so bad they have to go with a zero emission energy source like nuclear power. So it's all over the world that we're talking about. It's not just California, and we're all in this together. The ecosystem, things are interrelated in our ecosystem and our global environment, and whatever we can do now here of a positive nature hopefully will have a ripple effect, because it's already in the past had a ripple effect in a negative sense, so maybe we can do something positive.
Let's talk about retrofitting. I mean, if it takes off and it makes sense, it's clean, it's relatively inexpensive, and it's the right thing to do, so to speak, will we be able to retrofit?
Well, right now, if you have, let's say, a Rabbit or a Geo Prism or a Metro or whatever, and you brought it in to have it converted, it would cost between $12,000 to $15,000 to do that. It's expensive, but hopefully the automobile manufacturers will do that themselves in the plants, and through mass production, the price will come down considerably.
Now, of course, now we get to the visceral aspects of all this. You know, I'm sitting there saying, gee, should I retrofit my Jensen Healey, my 1974 Jensen Healey? Oh, he's shaking his head. It's probably not an official response. But now, electric motor, I mean, you're not going to get the rumble, the feel. I mean, do these motors have punch?
Well, yeah, actually, they can go 75 miles an hour.
That's cruising speed, Sheldon.
Yes.
Do they have punch?
they're not as good as the gasoline, but they'll get you in and out of traffic okay. And, you know, they're still working on the technology. We're talking about only today's technology. So with some more development, it'll have a little more, you know, pep to them. And
okay. I'm sure. Actually, if you can deliver the peppier one, then you've got the car people want to buy.
Sure.
My guest today is Dr. Sheldon Kamenecki. He's a researcher in the area of environmental policy, and he has frequently consulted with numerous government agencies in such areas as air quality, water quality, and energy use. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Now let's go back a little bit. It occurs to me now about the electric cars. This is an example of where the federal government and the state government have said, let's set these standards, meet this by this date, by this date, by this date. What if the technology isn't there? What happens in general? Now, we're just talking electric cars. It could be many different areas we're talking about. There's a danger in setting unrealistic goals.
Absolutely. One has to wonder whether 2% of the vehicles being electric is, we're asking all that much, and then going up to 10% in almost 9 years from now. So if the government creates a process in a atmosphere of competition, and there is fair competition, they will rush to try to get this going. Let's not forget, we send every 6 months a space shuttle up, around space, which is very extremely complicated and difficult to run. And we've had a very good record doing that, and we've made tremendous strides technologically. I just can't believe that the U.S. can't do this. And it's not only the U.S., there's other countries working on it. There are other companies working on it outside the automobile industry. I can't buy that. We're not really asking for like a new satellite or something here. We're asking for a fairly simple, in my mind, electric vehicle, and it shouldn't be difficult. In terms of the state versus federal question, which you asked actually about 15 minutes ago, I should have responded. It's interesting. Generally, the federal government influences the state governments, no doubt about it, at least 49 out of 50 times. California is very unique. And actually, what happened in the 1990 Clean Air Act, the state of California actually had moved forward before the federal government and influenced the development of the Clean Air Act in many points. And what the Clean Air Act did was to reaffirm and make the politicians and the elected officials in our state more comfortable, because now it was federal law, and of course Detroit was listening, and they've now gotten the message, hopefully, and we can move ahead and have cleaner air, hopefully, in the future.
What can we expect in the next 3, 5, 10 years in the area of hazardous materials?
I think in a place we've made the least progress has been in the disposal of hazardous and toxic materials, particularly if you look at Superfund. About a $10 billion program began in 1980. A third of the money is being spent for courts and lawyers, not for cleaning up sites. There are over 1,300 sites on the Superfund list, and only about 30 to 35 have been partially or fully abated. Not a very good record for all that money. And estimates are it'll cost maybe $100-150 billion, maybe more, to clean up all the other sites. So we're not doing a very good job, and I don't see that changing very much in the future. My other concern is about water quality. We have areas of the country that are right at the fringes. We've already had some incidences down in Southern California and other places where there was a temporary contamination of the water, chemical and bacterial. And as populations grow and we continue to expand, it's more difficult to continue to keep the water protected and clean so that it's drinkable. And we need to be more vigilant about that as well. I think those are the two areas, as well as a third area, air quality, where the federal government has to really concentrate and focus as we get into the next century.
Is that going to impact us tremendously in the pocketbook?
It shouldn't, because all we're asking is that industry do things differently rather than fining industry or raising necessarily directly the prices of the goods that they produce. In fact, in many cases, it's been shown that industry can actually save money. And a good example of that is the underground storage tank provisions under the 1984 Hazardous and Solid Waste Amendments, where a lot of gasoline tanks that are stored underground were leaking, and that's a product, and yet it was hurting the environment and so on. And those regulations benefited the gasoline companies because it forced them to prevent the leaking and stop the leaking, and it also helped the environment and public health. So those kinds of things are often very helpful to both industry and the public and the environment. And certainly when we're talking about quality of life, people don't want to live in an area that's polluted, either it's water, land, air, whatever. And industry knows that, because they're the first to move out when it gets really bad. They're also the first to protest when you ask them to try to clean up their act. And it's a dilemma.
Now, I'm interested when something is passed by, say, the federal government as a law versus a federal government agency issues a standard or a regulation. Who has to follow it? I mean, what are they going to do to you?
Okay, that's actually a larger question. Once Congress passes a law, generally it's somewhat a general and open law, and they will ask, let's say, the EPA, the Food and Drug Administration, or whatever agency, to set the standards concerning maybe, particular use of a pesticide or some sort of pollution control technology. Then it's up to the EPA to actually set the standards. If they don't act soon enough, usually Congress has given them deadlines and more recently has built in what we call hammer clauses, which means that the regulations will even be stiffer if EPA doesn't act as a result of course, industry pressuring them. Congress is getting very smart here. And so once that is done, then the states have to follow it. Now, generally, the states are free to make even stricter standards, which California has done in terms of recycling and some other areas, including air pollution. But the states are in the localities like San Francisco must first follow federal law. And when it's stricter, as laws are in California, then they have to also follow California law. And that's basically how it works. The federal government is preeminent in terms of lawmaking.
Say I'm the EPA and I've set a standard. What can I do to you?
Well, if I'm a state, you might want to take away several $100 million of my highway funds, for example. That
Ooh.
Would hurt. That would hurt. And in fact, EPA has threatened on several occasions to do that to California. Between you and me and our audience, I frankly do not think that California is going to be able to make it in 20 years by 2010. And there's just too many powerful interest groups in the state. I don't think the political system is ready to deal with them. And I think the EPA is eventually going to have to come in, whether they want to or not, because the environmental groups are going to force them to come in through the courts and basically tell California what they have to do. And in the end, it will be the businesses that have really been hurt. All the businesses that have been fighting this all along, they're probably going to have to change over a lot more quicker and a lot more costlier. So they still haven't realized this, unfortunately, and the day will come when we will have to obey the law. There will not be any more postponements in the current law.
So the major automobile manufacturers, to return to where we started out here, do they know that they're going to have to do this, or are they going to try some stalling tactics?
Well, above board and publicly, they will stall and say that we cannot meet the technology. You're asking for too sharp of a change. You're giving us until 1997. Those are the point you made before. That's only 3 years from now, and so on and so forth. And then privately, they run back to their laboratories and work day and night trying to develop it. You know, in case have to do it. And they'll probably be ready because they are smart and they have the economic resources. And we're not talking about sending a space shuttle up in space or new satellite. They're going to be able to pretty much do it and put it. They'll be ready. They'll be ready.
One issue that's very American is that we always think that a single person or a small company can really make it. Are all these new standards in any of these areas, is that going to hurt small business because they can't comply with all this, or is it going to help in some other way?
It depends on the kind of business it is. If it's a business directly related to, let's say, battery technology or electric motors or parts that will go into electric cars, it's amazing when you hear stories of someone came up with this little part and the business just took off, a computer chip of some sort or a software program for an electric car. Those kinds of industries, the technological industry, high-tech industry is going to be helped a lot. The maintenance on electric cars is very low, though, and hardly costs anything. And so maybe auto mechanic and body shops may not need to be in service, or certainly they'll have to be retrained if we go more and more towards electric cars, as well as the use of methanol and so on. And so maybe those businesses will be hurt. But generally, if we have cleaner air and a cleaner environment and a higher quality of life, everyone should benefit as a private citizen as well as a business. Housing prices should go up. The economy should benefit in general in the longer run.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest today has been Dr. Sheldon Kamenecki, the director of the Environmental Studies Program at the University of Southern California. His primary contributions have been in the area of state, federal, and international environmental policy. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. One way in which virtual reality is arriving on the scene is the new Virtual World Entertainment Centers, which are now opening worldwide. In your own enclosed capsule, you not only interact with your own virtual reality game, but you also must interact with others who are playing the game at the same time. Elizabeth McGrath and Nick Bassoni are now using this technology to help organizations build effective teams. I have the impression that people generally prefer to be leaders rather than team players. I asked them if this was true.
I think so. I think part of it is I don't want to be called a follower. I really want to be called a leader. And if I'm part of a group, I most prefer to be in charge of that group. And so people are needing to learn how to... There's a great quote by Scott Peck, who wrote The Different Drum. And he said, a team is, after all, a community of leaders. And I think we really need to all learn how to lead and how to be led by others and move that around. And we don't have much training for that.
Well, what you're doing is so new. It actually follows or rides on the crest of another breaking phenomenon. So I think everything needs a little bit of explaining here. First of all, we've been reading and hearing that virtual reality is coming. Virtual reality is coming. In major cities around the world, for the first time, people are now being able to go and experience virtual reality in an entertainment setting. So let's start by explaining what people will likely see first.
Well, they will come into what is indeed an entertainment setting, a facility called Virtual World. And they come in and there's a lounge area and a bar area and a whole bunch of TV monitors hanging around the place and people getting ready to go on a mission, on a Virtual World, virtual reality mission.
And each of those members would be sitting in a cockpit. So each individual would have a computer screen and a second screen that would be like a radar and foot pedals and a joystick and an accelerator bar.
How many people are in the room with that?
The way the technology works, up to 8 individuals can be linked together. So 8 people would go on the same virtual mission, and then they have groups of 8. So a group of up to 24 could be participating in much the same mission.
Now, in the entertainment section, which basically happens at night and on the weekends, what are you trying? Are you trying to go someplace or win something? What are we talking about?
They have two myths. One is to go to Solaris 7, and that's to be a pilot of something like a Star Wars mech, a 30-foot mechanized robot, and you would be competing with other mechs on that otherworldly location. And the second myth is called Red Planet, and there you're the pilot of a hovercraft in one of the mining canals of Mars.
So this sort of sounds like a glorified video game to me, and that's sort of the entertainment. Now, where you guys are going has to do with what do they do during the business week? What do we use that equipment for? And what are you guys doing?
Well, if we back up half a step, what sets it apart from being a glorified video game is that it's interactive. So you and I and Elizabeth all go on an evening, and we each get in our own cockpit. It's like we're each sitting in our own flight simulator. But what you do in your cockpit driving your 30-foot-tall robot, I can see you on the screen. I see the 30-foot-tall robot you're driving on the screen, and you see me. And so what we each do and what Elizabeth does as well, we can all see each other, and we impact on each other.
But we see each other on the screen.
Don't
see each other in the building itself.
Right.
So we're really interacting with the video there, but we see the people we came with.
Right. In fact, we're each in a closed cockpit, so we aren't seeing each other in reality at all, but we're seeing each other's robots on the screen.
Now, what do you do?
Well, for instance, if in a competitive situation I were to say, I'm going to find you, then you could be very good at hiding and Nick might not be so good at hiding. What we've decided to do is use the technology and set the context that instead of being competitive, it's fundamentally collaborative. So we 8, let's say it's an intact group of 8, we would all go to the Red Planet, and we would go through a series of missions, the first one being individual, so that we can get familiar with the technology. Then we'd work together in duets. So I would coach you, and you would coach me, and we'd use the technology to see what it feels like to be coached, maybe even what it feels like to be coached by somebody who's not as good as you are. And then finally we move into a group effort where the full group is responsible for doing something better than we could do individually. So we set the context to be cooperative and then use the technology to be the vehicle for something that's new and unusual.
Did you rewrite the games so or the myths so that this could occur? What did you do?
We rewrote the context, basically said, okay, folks, let's assume that we're not competing. Let's assume that we're cooperating. And that was about all that it took. And the computer picks up the rest of it. It will provide feedback to each individual to say how well I did, how well you did, how well somebody else did. It will accumulate for us our ability to go fast, our ability to avoid
collisions. Avoid colliding with each other or avoid colliding with something else, because the vehicles accumulate damage as that happens. And eventually you collide yourself out of existence if you do that enough.
If you walk into the wall, we penalize you. That's good.
Like enough times.
Okay, now let me get the picture straight. I'm sitting there, and I'm in the seat number one, and I've got a robot, and that's me. And the assignment that I have is to work with you guys. All us robots work together to do something.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the collaborative portion of it, which is much different than we think of video games, as I'm trying to shoot you or take your arm
right.
off or blow right. something up. That's sort of the natural thing we've come to understand. You've just completed a pilot project. Tell us about that.
Okay, we began in Chicago, and that was where the first prototype for the virtual world location was created. And we worked primarily with professionals with AT&T who were real well acquainted with what were the various things out in the world that provided vehicles for team development. More and more organizations are saying they need to be team-driven, and so they tested out our theories with us. What we're able to do is use a virtual reality setting to incrementally move an individual into a partnership and into a team setting, and then have that team learn how to better observe its own efforts, give each other feedback, and effectively become a breakthrough team in a virtual world.
How many people did you use to do that?
We had about, I think, 16 people, and the particular pilot in Chicago was all done with people who were internal AT&T consultants. So their job was to see if they liked the technology, see what promise they thought it had, and then if they liked it, begin to figure out ways to use it themselves with the AT&T population.
And they knew each other?
They worked together, and they were a team, or they were at least a group, and thought of themselves often as a team, and their common mission was to be the internal consultants to the central region of AT&T.
Well, what did you learn?
Let's see, we learned a couple things. One was that our design had merit. The incremental approach, a lot of people really appreciated, found that too often they're thrown into a team or a group setting with little opportunity to personally get comfortable. And so the first segment or the first mission is get comfortable. And they then in the afternoon talked about, well, how could we benefit from that awareness, how much better we do when we're given a little bit of slack time, a little bit of time to get more able to do what's expected of us. The second was that the second cycle is partnership, and they realized that they had done very little about conscious partnering. The assumption is that I might mentor someone who's new to the organization, but it tends not to be formalized. And they decided that what they really needed to do was look at what was the complement of people in that group and figure out what would be reasonable pairings so that over a six-month period, I would basically buddy up with Tom and George would buddy up with Denise and begin to share perspective, share expertise, share experience.
There's a nice image for that partnering notion. Elizabeth has been talking with folks about, you remember Boy Scout camp or Girl Scout camp or summer camp, where the first thing they did was say buddy up with somebody, assign each person a partner for the summer, and every time periodically through the day they'd blow a whistle, and when they did that you had to find your partner and hold their hands up so that they knew that nobody had drowned, nobody had gone swimming too quick after lunch or whatever. It's the same idea with teams. If one of the necessary stages is figure out how to be good partners on the way to figuring out how to be good members of a larger group.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Elizabeth McGrath and Nick Bassoni. They are principals in the Lakeland Group, which is pioneering the use of virtual reality in enabling teams of people to work together. I keep thinking of how many people that I've had to be on a team with. As an engineer, you're always a part of a team. And you say, well, that guy just can't work with anybody. I mean, do you find that out fairly early?
Well, we find that people tend to have either unmet expectations or inappropriate expectations. Part of what we do in the team development experience is not only have them go through this developmental cycle, but in the afternoon reflect on each of those cycles. And part of what we teach in that afternoon is how to explore difference of opinion. Too often people are bombastic when they're not getting what they want, or they pull away, they become somewhat petulant. And so we found that one of the key things that most teams are missing is the ability to have a productive dialogue. So we teach a dialogue process, and then they use that process as they reflect on the morning. The hope being that they'll leave with a better sense of how to raise those kinds of issues and how to work them through to some kind of satisfactory conclusion.
Okay, so Elizabeth, let's say you and I are going to be partners here in partnering. Are you and I in two separate enclosures?
More often than not, the second cycle has me sitting next to you and coaching you mm-hmm. as you pilot your hovercraft, and then we switch. We go back to my hovercraft and you coach me. But after that second cycle, we then spend the rest of the time, I have mine, you have yours, the other six people have theirs, and we then discuss between cycles how things are going, who's helping whom, who might better be a support or a coach to another person.
So when, let's go back to this idea of I'm sitting there managing the hovercraft and you're sitting next to me. How do you monitor our interaction?
Actually, all we do is set aside the time and the opportunity. And people monitor themselves.
And they discuss it mm-hmm. and come up with a solution.
But after each cycle, each individual will take the time to write down what I liked best about coaching someone else, mm-hmm. what I liked least about coaching someone else, what surprised me, and what I learned. And therefore, in the afternoon, that becomes the fodder for the individuals to look at. Some people liked it, some people didn't. What's real positive is there's invariably someone who's a really good coach. That'll come up in conversation in the afternoon. So then we'll have a model of good coaching. So even if I didn't coach you particularly well, Tina will have coached Sam, and that'll come up in conversation. So you don't necessarily have to tell me how poorly I do. It's just that you're not real ecstatic. And then in the afternoon, as Tina talks about Sam, I then begin to hear how good coaching feels like from the receiver's point of view.
And the organization begins to understand who might be a more talented coach than mm-hmm. others.
And what's interesting is historically most organizations have rewarded the more forward, the more assertive, and coaches tend to be the more contemplative, the ones who kind of notice the opening and slip in but don't push it through. And so it begins to correct some of the misapprehensions that people have about personality style and mm-hmm. find that this person might be a good promoter, but this other kind of person is a really good coach. And we end up leaving that setting with a higher level of appreciation for the variety of talents each person does.
Okay, so we come out of there, we've been doing individual partnering, and now we're ready for the group to interact. How does that work?
Well, the group will have a task to perform, like find some location in the virtual universe that they're in and gather there and be there by a certain time. Sounds simple, but it's a little bit more complicated because they're just getting used to this technology. Or in one of the other myths, their mission might be to complete as many circuits through the mining canals of Mars as they can in the given amount of time, thereby accruing points. And the point score will have to do with how well the team did, not how well individuals did. So we're not setting it up so that my object is to get more points than you. What we need to do is use our talents collectively so that we maximize total points among the group. So it's a simple mission, but we have to be able to communicate with each other and watch what we're doing and give each other some tips as we go. So I see you on the screen and you're repeatedly crashing into some overhead obstacle because you're not hitting the button that gets you down at ground level quick enough. And you're coming off a ramp and crashing into something instead of getting your hovercraft back down low. So I can tell you about that as we're running through the course.
So I can push an intercom button and say, Joe, push the down button before you do that.
Right, right. Now everybody will hear you. The whole team will hear that because when you push your button, we're all hearing what you have to say. But it doesn't prevent you from being able to tell me something clearly about what I need to do.
And one of the strengths of the technology is after that cycle is completed, the full group goes to a debriefing station, and you can look at the entire mission in QuickTime and see everybody's hovercraft moving through the canals and begin to talk about misunderstandings or efforts that didn't quite work or success that somebody can share with somebody else. Too often we think competitively instead of you're better at X than I am. That's your contribution to the degree that you're willing to help me and the rest of us get better at what you're already good at. That's really making a team solid. So the technology gives us the opportunity to review in QuickTime what we just went through.
You know, it really, this is just a sense because I haven't participated in this, but I've seen so often in engineering this kind of behavior. One guy will be really fast, so he'd shoot all the way to the front, and even though you got to get the last guy in, he'd just kind of sit there. You know, you want to be able to say, you two are passive aggressive. I knew it. I was cooperating and you weren't. I mean, this just seems like a meta look at how groups really operate. And because it's one level away, there you are in the screen. You're able to replay it and go, well, you see, you know, you were up there. You knew how to get up there. Why didn't you say anything the whole time? Versus you were saying this and I wasn't getting it. And, you know, I can imagine that the repercussions of this are pretty amazing.
Also, the way that the technology will support the process of improvement. Cycle 3 is the first time the group, as a group, attempts to do something. That creates kind of benchmark or just foundation figures. Then we, as a group, need to figure out how to do even better the next time. So the task stays the same, but the intention is to build on and share expertise. And so the virtual reality technology really allows us to repeat in basically the same construct what we just did. And it's pretty amazing how with thoughtful sharing, the numbers and the sense of success goes up enormously. And the group did it for and with themselves.
My guests today are Elizabeth McGrath and Nick Bissoni. Their interest is in using the technology of virtual reality in team building. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. You knew now who your teammates are through all this.
Yes.
Right? That's not double blind.
Yeah, what we're doing is working with organizations, typically corporate kinds of entities. But what we want to do is have groups of people who, in fact, work with each other in the day-to-day real-life setting. So pretty typically, the reason you and I are there on the same day and the same morning is because we, in fact, interact all the time at work. And maybe there are six or eight other people who also interact with us. We're interdependent somehow. That's how the group gets defined.
Unfortunately, in whatever would be the old days, we would be called a team just because we reported to the same person. Now a lot of organizations are rethinking their structure and saying, through the process of reengineering, for instance, that an interdependent group is responsible overall for this outcome. So now the structure is reflecting the task. Those are the folks that we want to work with, that they are by definition interdependent. And because they're interdependent, they really, whether they want to or not, they need to figure out strategies for working together well.
Now, if an organization wanted to send a department or their top managers or any group, what would be the process and how long would it take to get through sort of the total, the big picture?
Well, basically, we would, through a series of conversations, we would agree that they would meet us on a given day in the morning at 8 o'clock, and the actual virtual reality portion of the day is 8 to noon. So from 8 to noon, we would be going through the cycles that Elizabeth was describing earlier with the whole group. And sometimes it might be more than one team at a time. We might have two or even three teams in the same reality, but each concentrating on their own interaction within mm-hmm. their own team. And that's a morning. And then we go to lunch with the group, and people pretty typically start talking about what's been happening because it's absorbing, challenging stuff. And in the afternoon, we want to take them and have a more structured conversation about what did all that mean in the morning. Because in the morning, people pretty much stick with the myth. They get absorbed in the virtual universe. In the afternoon, we want to take them away to a meeting facility somewhere and get them to focus on how do we make the application between what we experienced this morning and the clean system we were operating in and the clear feedback that we got. How do we apply that to real world, what do we do with each other day to day? So we would spend an afternoon working with them on that and helping that conversation move and explore and hopefully get to insights.
So you can actually get a lot done in just one day.
Actually, the feedback that we've gotten from folks who've spent a lot of time or had a whole variety of team development experiences is that the learning time is much shorter, much quicker. There's a whole lot more to be learned more quickly because we can manage the time. Each cycle is just 10 minutes, and then about 20 minutes between cycles for the group to prepare themselves for the next cycle. And because we're not outdoors, you can move more quickly. So between the hours of 8 and noon, you've actually had 5 discrete experiences, conversations about those experiences, and then taken some notes on a per-cycle basis about what you liked and didn't like, what surprised you and what you learned, and all that then feeds into the afternoon where people really take responsibility for deriving meaning from those experiences. What does it mean that this whole group, except for one person, really appreciated the opportunity to work alone first? What are the implications of that? That group has to figure out what to do with that data.
Well, you know, that's another good point, and that is there is no right answer. Mm-hmm. And it's like how they work together, if they can start improving and getting better and understanding how it translates to their normal business situation, then that's a success.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's another interesting thing is I see so many different definitions of what success and failure. That must come into play here as well.
Mm-hmm. And our job as facilitators is just to tease out the question and help them sort through their own perceptions and arrive at their own conclusions.
But speaking of success and failure, what we run into repeatedly is that the organization does a lot of talking about teamwork and interdependence and the need to learn consciously about that, but the reward systems often are still geared for the individual. So it's who gets there first is with the mostest that the organization still rewards. So it's not surprising that you're going to continue to get a lot of individually oriented behavior in that real world because the reward system is still set up to affirm that or reinforce it.
So do you bring that up in the afternoon?
Mm-hmm. Or they bring it up as well. What they might find is that, well, currently the organization doesn't reward on teams, but they're planning to. It's a 2-year process. They're revamping their entire appraisal system. So then that team could say, well, so what can we do in the short term to support and promote our own teamship even as the organization continues to reinforce individual effort? What can we do to kind of push out the edges of that to sustain our own team membership? So it's taking a deeper responsibility for their own reward and communication system rather than saying, the organization, it's their fault.
Did you have to work with the people developing the technology to change anything, or were you able to just to use the games as they were?
We use the games as they were because the industry at this point is really entertainment driven, and that's what their eye was on, that entertainment application. But we took a look at the myths, the universes that were already in being, and said, how can we create tasks given what's there without having to do major software rewrites or hardware changes? Can we figure out things that make sense collaboratively for teams to focus on rather than they're out there shooting and killing and so on?
Well, Virtual World is now, the majority ownership is with Tim Disney, the grandnephew of Walt Disney, and his intention is clearly to have an impact, a responsible impact in the education and training field. And so currently what we're doing is funded by entertainment dollars, but ultimately the expectation is that the education and training effort will define its own needs and create their own myths. But in the meantime, we found that we can very responsibly use the Red Planet and have the information on an individual basis, really have people focus on, here's what I'm doing, here's somebody who's doing it better, how can I learn? And have people struggle with, do I want to teach you that? Really heavy duty stuff.
That withholding mm-hmm. happens a lot in these teams, I've mm-hmm. noticed.
Mm-hmm. Comes from an individual reward system.
Yeah, it can come from a lot of places from what I've seen. Now, right now, you mentioned that you could do it here locally in San Francisco in the Walnut Creek, California area,
mm-hmm.
very close by. Where else in the world can you do this?
San Diego. Chicago. There's one opening soon in Dallas. I think it's 1st of June. Las Vegas will have actually 32 cockpits rather than 24, and that's early July. And then basically a rollout across the country, probably 1 to 2 per month for the next year or two.
So that as they, you start to see those facilities locally in your area, then your organization can certainly use those to, in collaboration mm-hmm. with the Lakeland Group to bring about this kind of development. That's, mm-hmm. that's very exciting. Elizabeth, Nick, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
My guests today have been Elizabeth McGrath and Nick Bassoni, principals in the Lakeland Group, which uses virtual reality to better enable teams of people to work together. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Barry Evans' perspective today is called Unnatural Highs.
Scattered around the world are artificial great climbs. I'm not speaking of nature's Everest or Whitney reaching skyward several miles above their surroundings, but of human-made structures, generally a few hundred feet high. In contrast to nature's icy slopes and vertical rocky walls, they're usually accessible by stairs or, heaven forbid, elevators. No crampons, pitons, or ropes are needed to ascend the dome of St. Peter's in Rome or the Space Needle in Seattle. Like a bee to nectar, a certain type of traveler is drawn to climb them whenever they are in the vicinity. Rich or poor, male or female, young or old, don't seem to matter much. Athletic ability has little to do with it either. I've seen an Oriental lady celebrating her 85th birthday peering out of Liberty's crown, and a blind man being helped up the 400 steps of Siena's great Mangia Tower. Given the choice of walking around the ornate floor of Paris Notre Dame or walking up its many, many steps to the roof, these travelers head for the roof. Our love of unnatural highs goes back at least 5,000 years to the time of the pyramids. The most famous of all, the Great Pyramid of Cheops, required over 2 million blocks of limestone, each weighing about the same as a Honda Civic. That may seem like a complicated way to get 482 feet above its surroundings, but what a rush it must have been for those early flatlanders to gaze from its apex for miles and miles through the then unpolluted desert air. The ancient Egyptians built over 90 pyramids. Perhaps 500 more are to be found in South and Central America, Cyprus, Sudan, Thailand, and Burma, all of them straining to rise above the ground below. The Middle Ages gave us the great European cathedrals, hollow pyramids, if you will, from which a person could view the world from up high. 10 years before the invention of the airplane, it was possible to be lifted over 200 feet into the air without climbing a single stair, if you happen to be in Chicago. That's where George Ferris's original wheel was built for the 1893 World Columbian Exposition. His wheel could carry more than 2,000 people at a time, affording them a spectacular view of the exposition grounds from their temporary vantage point, 250 feet above the ground. Each of these edifices I've mentioned gives people a means of escaping from their two-dimensional, earthbound view of life, and allows them to see their surroundings from another perspective. In the same way that a fresh piece of information or insight can give us a new mental perspective, pyramids, towers, cathedrals, and Ferris wheels can give us a new physical point of view. Perhaps Rapunzel, imprisoned high in the Wizard's Tower, could have found some consolation. The view, after all, must have been magnificent.
Barry Evans is the author of the syndicated column Star Watch. His most recent book is Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.